The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Hello. We are going to go ahead and get started. So if you could find a place to sit, where you're going. Welcome to Park Church, at least our building. We are really excited about what's happening here this weekend. And we're really excited that you're here with us this morning. We are trying to periodically host, sometimes annually, sometimes twice a year, whenever, symposiums that help us and help our people think about what does it mean to live as a faithful presence in the midst of our city and our culture. And a lot of that has to do with where do we see the intersection between what we confess and believe to be true about God and what he's done in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and how do we live out our lives faithfully in the midst of this world. And so we host these every once in a while, and we are excited to do that now. We want to host a bunch of pastors to help us think through these things together. All of you are invited tonight and tomorrow night. We'll be doing an event tonight speaking, thinking through liturgies of the world, and then tomorrow night thinking through liturgies in the church, and then how those two things intersect. So we invite you to that. It starts at 6. We should be done about 8:30 tonight and tomorrow night. I get to introduce Jamie Smith, and I've never met him until this morning, except for the occasional tweet, which is an odd thing. You're way nicer in person. Jamie Smith is a professor of philosophy at Calvin College. He is a fellow with the Center for Christian Worship at the Institute for Christian Worship at Calvin College as well. He's written a number of books. We have several of them back on the table back there. I just wanted to speak just a minute to his book, Desiring the Kingdom. This book is one of my top five in terms of impact and shaping my understanding of ministry in a local church. What does it mean to be a pastor? And then I'll add to that what it means to be a dad. The implications of his work there have shaped not only our ministry here at Park Church, but my home as much as any other writer I know, in terms of thinking about and asking the question, how do we shape the affections, the desires, the longings of people? How do we do that? I mean, that seems like such an impossible task. And then to look at your children and as they grow, wrestle with, man, how do I shepherd them, care for them, but also, man, create a kind of environment in our home that shepherds their hearts in particular directions to love, delight in who God is and what it means to be truly human and bear his image. And so I'm thankful to Jamie, not only for the life of our church, I'm thankful to Jamie for the impact he's had on my wife and I's life as we've thought about our marriage, as we've thought about what it means to raise children and the role that liturgies play as one of the means that God uses to create desire and cultivate desire in us for things that align with his will for us. So I want to pray for this weekend. Our hope is that it would shape not only our church, but a number of different churches in thinking through these things well, and our life in the city, as we seek to and love our city well, lay down our lives for the sake of people in our city, and call them to know and worship and love Jesus. So let me pray for the weekend, and then Jamie will come up. So Father, what must you be like? That you don't merely interact with us one-on-one, but you call us into this living community called the church, a church that is both incredibly local and yet spans time and spans states, so that different voices are raised up by your spirit to speak, to shape the life of your church. And so, God, we give thanks for the two brothers that have come to speak to us and to help us think hard about what it means to faithfully be your people in this world. And we see them as a gift from you. And so, God, we pray that you'd use them. You'd use them not just at Park Church, but for the sake of our city, and to be a voice of what does it mean to minister in a secular place? What does it mean to bear witness to the resurrection of Jesus in a secular place? And what does it mean to cultivate longings and desires in our people that form them for faithful presence and mission? We love you. We ask for your help, that you'd speak and bring clarity. In your name we pray, amen.
Second. I have a deep appreciation for what the Spirit is doing here in Denver. I haven't been here in a long time, and it's exciting to dip into that and be part of what you're up to. Thanks, too, brother, for that introduction about family. That really means a lot to me. I wish, my kids are old now, you know, I've got 3 in college and a junior in high school, and I wish I knew some of these things when I was younger, and I sometimes get anxious about that. But then it turns out that God can work so in spite of you as a father. And it is one of the coolest things that you'll get to experience is seeing your kids desire what you want them to desire. It's just the most, it's like, I can die now. We have a daughter who is 18, who is the exact representation of her mother's gifts of hospitality. And that is such a missional reality. I'm just very thankful for it. I want to invite you to think with me this morning, and then we're going to have lots of time for conversation and Q&A. I want to emphasize and try to invite you to see yourselves as ethnographers. So I think it is very important that pastors and church planters cultivate the skills of what in the social sciences we would call ethnography. Now let me explain, let me back up and explain that for a second. There was a French theorist in the 20th century named Pierre Bourdieu. I can't say anything unless I'm talking about Augustine or some French theorist. That's just the way it goes. Pierre Bourdieu was, we often sort of think of him as a French philosopher, a postmodern philosopher. What was interesting is that Bourdieu was actually an anthropologist who studied other cultures. And I think one of the most brilliant insights that came out of Bourdieu's work is that as he would try to understand these other cultures, he would sort of move in as the sort of participant observer, whatever it might be. He sort of moves into these, a lot of this was in Micronesia and things like that. He's trying to understand the kind of worldview, if you will, of these cultures. And he went there starting with the expectation that he could basically take the artifacts that that culture had produced and understand the culture. In fact, what he largely brought was a kind of Western set of expectations that if I want to understand what makes a culture tick, I need to read the documents that they produce. Well, that quickly failed, mostly because he was reading a culture that didn't produce documents, that didn't articulate things propositionally. And so he came with a whole set of skills to try to understand a culture that were really primed for understanding a very narrow sort of bandwidth of rational exploration and articulation, but that wasn't there. And even when it was there, it wasn't really what made that culture tick. So what he had to do was create a whole new sort of ethnographic model where he comes in order to understand this culture, he can't just read their documents, he has to read their practices. He basically has to become an exegete of what they do, not a reader of what they say. And so that pushed him to this whole sort of methodological shift in developing what he calls a logic of practice, where he cultivates these ethnographic skills of trying to kind of read between the lines of what people do in order to dig down into what really makes them tick. And there's a much longer conversation that could be had about that, but I think that kind of posture of ethnographic attention to practices is exactly what we need if we are going to properly understand the so-called secular age in which we find ourselves. So if you really want to understand what makes a sort of secular culture tick, if you want to understand the pulse of that culture, what you can't do is just rely on the documents and propositions and intellectual articulations that those cultures generate, because in fact, in some ways, those will be misleading. So I want to think with you this morning about a different way to read our secular age, so to speak. And in doing so, I also want to encourage us to rethink the posture that we would take with respect to a secular age. And I'll just preface it this way, and this can be part of the conversation. If I'm misreading it, I'm happy to know. For example, if you think the way to understand what's really at stake in our secular age is to read the New Atheists, you will miss the point. Okay? So if don't fall into the trap of thinking that Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchin are the sort of spokespeople for a secular culture. They are a loud, vocal, saber-rattling minority. But in fact, the documents that they produce, I don't think, really do justice to how interestingly ambiguous and complex the world of doing is, the world of practices that constitutes a secular age. Okay? And so what happens is, though, is so many of us as Protestant evangelicals, we are like super comfortable with reading documents. We love reading documents. We love generating documents. We love ideas. Listen, I get paid as a philosopher. So I'm all for thinking. I love thinking. But we actually overestimate thinking. And so what happens is, because we are so comfortable in the world of sort of propositional articulation and rational delineation, that we therefore gravitate to an analysis of our cultural moment that also fixates on the documents. But if all you do is that, you will miss a very different story that is happening at the level of practice. That's part of what got me interested in Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who for me is sort of an ethnographer of our current moment. And so I just want to lay out a few themes this morning that I think should maybe perhaps cultivate a slightly different posture of what it looks like to be faithfully present. I love the Hunter shout out. To be faithfully present to a secular age. Because I think if you move away from fixating on these sort of new atheist articulations as if that was the pulse, it will also move us away from a posture that is largely defensive and oppositional. Right? Because I totally understand that. If you really thought that Richard Dawkins was sending you reports from the center of a secular age, we should be worried. Right? And we should probably spend all of our time writing books in response to the new atheists. It turns out there's a few people who do that. All I'm saying is that might actually be a misdirection of some of our energy, because this is not a report from the center. It's actually a report from the fringe. And the reports from the center are much more interesting. Let me suggest, and once you hear those reports from the center, I think it changes the posture of our Christian engagement with the secular culture, from sort of defensive shooting from behind the barricades to actually an open invitation to help people find what they're looking for, right? That it's a much more, it's a stance of hospitality rather than defense. And I want to preface it that it won't be, that doesn't mean that there's no room for critique. It's just that the context of the critique will be different. Let me give you an example. I think that our secular age is much more ambiguous, complex, nuanced, and hungry than the new atheist would ever lead you to believe. That there are kind of ghosts in the secular machine. That there are these, when you really start to listen at the level of practices and what people are doing, so to speak, on the ground, you'll start to see these skylights in the brass heaven of a disenchanted world, and that there is still a kind of openness and hunger, so that our secular age remains haunted. And I think the haunting of our secular age is exactly the sort of opening and opportunity into which the gospel emerges. Let me try to give you a few examples of this. And I'm immediately intimidated because most of you are like way younger and way cooler than I am. And so I'm going to like try to do this sort of pop culture thing, and it's going to fall flat. But you think of better examples, and then we can talk about it. Here's the kind of vibe I'm talking about. So there's a British novelist named Julian Barnes, who still is underappreciated this side of the Atlantic. But his last novel that got some attention over here was called Sense of an Ending, which was actually really well reviewed. Barnes, to me, is the poster child of the sort of European secular individual. Okay, he really is, you know, he's never gone to church. I mean, he really has just had a thoroughgoing secular upbringing. Has no religious interest or investments at all. And yet, in 2008, he published this fascinating memoir called Nothing to be Frightened Of, in which he says this line: I don't believe in God, but I miss him. I don't believe in God, but I miss him. That's what a secular age looks like. So, and what's interesting is that Barnes, who has, again, no religious project whatsoever, himself is critical of the new atheists. I don't believe in God, but I miss him. That sort of vague sense of loss is actually much more pervasive than we might realize. And for my money, it is woven through almost everything that Ben Gibbard has ever written. So Postal Service, Death Cab for Cutie, that remarkable partnership between Ben Gibbard and Jay Farrar where they did Kerouac's On the Road as an album. You listen to this music, listen to the lyrics, and you will hear this incredibly, sometimes muted and yet still present, hunger and longing. It's also, we could totally do a Wes Anderson analysis here too. But let me give you one example. Listen to this lyric from Clark Gable, the song Clark Gable. I want so badly to believe that there is truth and love is real, and I want life in every word to the extent that it's absurd. And I'm looking through the glass where the light bends at the cracks, and I'm screaming at the top of my lungs, pretending the echoes belong to someone, someone I used to know. That's longing. That's longing for something. And that sort of vibe, I think, is much more characteristic of the cultural spaces in which people find themselves. I'll give you another example. Think of, it'd be fun to say, how many have iPhones in their pocket this morning? Okay. That's actually a slightly lower ratio than I was expecting. But anyway. Okay, Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs, icon of cultural influence in late modernity, right? Absolute exemplary sort of picture of a kind of creative and technological way of inhabiting the world. Here's what's interesting. Steve Jobs does not live in the disenchanted world of the new atheists. Even though he's somebody who's governing the world of sort of technology and design, what's interesting is if you read Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, which I highly recommend, heartbreaking story, you'll see that someone like Steve Jobs, again, inhabits a much more ambiguous space than the new atheists would lead you to believe. Here's one story. This is near the end of his life. For those who might not remember, Steve Jobs died much too young of cancer and largely because of hubris. Because he believed that he could solve it by his own control of his diet. Okay? So it's a really, really tragic story. This is an episode from late in his life. One sunny afternoon, when he wasn't feeling well, Jobs sat in the garden behind his house and reflected on death. He talked about his experiences in India almost four decades earlier, his study of Buddhism, his views on reincarnation and spiritual transcendence. I'm about 50-50 on believing in God, he said. For most of my life, now, I want to just stop. See, in a secular age, 50-50 is pretty interesting, isn't it? Really? Do you know what I mean? Like, I could start there. Let's start there. 50-50? I'll take that bet. For most of my life, he says, I felt that there must be more to human existence than meets the eye. He admitted that as he faced death, he might be overestimating the odds out of a desire to believe in an afterlife. I like to think that something survives after you die, he said. It's strange to think that you accumulate all this experience and maybe a little wisdom and it just goes away. So I really want to believe that something survives, that maybe your consciousness endures. He fell silent for a very long time. But on the other hand, maybe it's like an on-off switch. Click, and you're gone. And then he paused again and he smiled slightly. Maybe that's why I never like to put on-off switches on Apple devices. Right? There's a sort of haunting there. Why don't I want things to turn off? Because I don't want to turn off. And there's this, and there's an honesty about what he's hoping for. One other sort of example. These to me are little signals from a secular age that tell you that it's much more interesting than the new atheists would tell you. The other one that I'm fascinated by, and I just have to talk about with this wherever I go because nobody has seen it. HBO produced a documentary called God is the Bigger Elvis. Has anybody ever seen this? Yeah, fascinating. I think this would be a brilliant thing to screen with a small group or even with a congregation. God is the Bigger Elvis. Here's the story. Dolores Hart is a Hollywood starlet in the late 50s and early 60s and is living the dream. She is starring alongside Elvis, Warren Beatty, all kinds of sort of leading men. She is on a chart to be sort of the leading Hollywood starlet. She's engaged to be married. She visits a Benedictine convent in Connecticut for a little retreat, and it lodges something in her heart that she just can't get out. She goes back to Hollywood. She tries to live this life again. It doesn't work. Eventually, she enters that convent in 1963 and has been there ever since, cloistered, literally behind a screen. She, if I recall correctly, she had been engaged at the time. She entered the convent in her wedding dress, which I think is gorgeous. And her fiancé has been her best friend for the rest of her life, and they meet every single week and end every meeting by saying, I love you. Now, there's on its own account, this is a fascinating story. Here's what fascinates me. This documentary is made by HBO. Think of this. The people who make Game of Thrones produce a documentary about a woman who gives up all of the sort of liberty of the culture that she was part of in order to cloister herself and submit herself to rules of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Why does HBO care? Right? And not only do they care, it is incredibly well done. And this is not like Christopher Hitchens wrote a book on Mother Teresa one time that is a complete hatchet job and sort of mob hit on Mother Teresa. This documentary by HBO, which again, this is not a focus on the family production, okay? This documentary by HBO is absolutely respectful and I would even say slightly puzzled yet mesmerized that somebody would do this. And to me, it's a signal that while everybody is sort of celebrating and giving awards to Game of Thrones, there's some sort of surd in our consciousness and experience that makes us wonder if this isn't actually the good life. That maybe the freedom we tout in so many other places is not the liberation that we think it is. To me, those are all fascinating aspects that are the secular age in which you minister. So I think what we have to appreciate is when you start listening on the ground, when you start looking at these sort of signals from popular culture, when you start actually listening to the fraught, complex space that people inhabit, what you start to realize is they don't have, that the new atheists are just fundamentalists on the other end of the spectrum. And actually, nobody is really attracted to fundamentalism. Unless they're working through sort of daddy issues. Do you know what I mean? Like there's just so many ways that you can, that there's other things going on there. It does not have allure. It does not have attraction. It does not have a pull or power about it. People live in the middle space. So what then you start to realize is this. Let me give you a short, quick way, because I do want to make sure we leave time for conversation. Charles Taylor offers a very different way to read our secular age. And it starts with simply this. When you hear the word secular, don't think unbelief. A secular age is not synonymous with unbelief. What makes our age a secular age is not that it's an atheistic age. To be honest, there are not that many people who sign up to be atheists. What do they sign up for? They want to be spiritual but not religious. It's a kind of agnosticism. And that's the space that they want to live in. And if you're... No, I understand. There's one way in which a Christian view of that looks at that and says, you fucking agnostic. Come on, have some courage. But do you see how there's another way to look at that and say, agnosticism? I can start from there. Right? That's Mars Hill. That's Acts 17. Right? You meet people in the ambiguity of the places that they are. You even meet them in the ambiguity of their doubts. Taylor says, what makes our age a secular age is not that it's an age of unbelief. What it does mean, though, is it's an age in which no one's belief is taken to be axiomatic or taken for granted or the default. No one's belief can be assumed to be the universal default belief anymore. A secular age is an age in which everyone's belief is contestable and contested. Make sense? And again, we don't have to have big epistemological conversations about that. It's as simple as the fact that you live beside neighbors who actually turn out to be really good people, and they don't believe what you believe. Ergo, we must live in a world in which the plausibility structures have changed and not everybody believes some default belief. That's what it is to be in a secular age. Okay? Everyone's beliefs are contestable and contested. Now, this is actually why, if you have a proper nuanced understanding of the secular, you also have everything you need to call into question an aggressive secularism, right? Which wants to, you know, dominate the public square. Because a secularism is actually a belief that hasn't owned up to the secularity of our moment. It's a belief that hasn't owned up to the contestability of its own belief. That could be a longer conversation, but that's kind of the move you have to make if you read the New York Times op-ed page, right? Everything Frank Bruni says needs to be undercut in that way. Okay, maybe you don't read the New York Times west of the Mississippi. I don't know how that goes. Okay, so in a secular age, then, everyone's belief is contestable and contested. Now, what that changes, then, is not whether people believe, but how people believe. I do think it's important for those of us who are ministering in terms of discipleship and Christian formation to own up to this reality, okay? To recognize that we all inhabit that space. And that means to become a Christian and to grow in the Christian faith in a secular age is different than it was in 1500. I'm not saying we believe different things. I'm not saying we relax the requirements of what we believe. All I'm saying is the environmental conditions in which you are formed in the faith and discipled are different. And so, you know, we can read Richard Baxter and glean it for all kinds of insights, but the fact is the kids that Richard Baxter is talking to are not our kids. They're not living in the same... In fact, the world has changed. And so what we have to do is be honest that if all beliefs are contestable and contested, we have to recognize that a natural part of discipleship is letting, for example, young people and new Christians work through the contestability of Christian faith. Is that fair? There is a sense in which doubt is not sin. Okay? Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. That's the kind of honesty that we're talking about. And I think that if the church is not honest about those plausibility conditions in which we are forming people in the faith, we will actually lose more than we keep, because people are going to start to say, I feel like you're trying to hide something, or hide from something or pretend something. And that's not that. Then they'll start worrying about the intellectual credibility of the Christian faith. God doesn't have to be scared of any of our questions. He's not. That's why he gave us the Psalms. All the questions are there. And so if we fear, then we unwittingly communicate something about the intellectual mushiness of the gospel. Okay, so that makes a difference on the discipleship side. On the evangelism side, what's interesting is, okay, so in a secular age where everybody's beliefs are contestable and contested, it does mean that even those who continue to believe in Christ believe in an environment which creates new challenges. However, it also means that unbelievers are haunted too, right? So Taylor says, the situation of a secular age is an age in which everybody experiences these cross pressures, okay? These pulls and pushes and tugs in this really fraught, contested, ambiguous space. And if you're a believer, that creates new challenges. But what's interesting is, unbelievers are tempted too. Do you know what they're tempted by? Belief. The doubter's doubt is faith. And if you change your posture and start from the assumption that actually, even in their sort of I'm spiritual but not religious front, that is already a sign that they are haunted. And now what you're just doing is giving them permission to entertain the faith that's hounding them. Right? Makes a huge difference. There's no guarantees. I'm not saying there's some formula to trip a switch. I just think it changes the posture that we bring to this experience. Now, okay. I'm gonna wrap up because I want to hear what you all are thinking about this. I will say one last piece. The spiritual but not religious phenomenon is, I think, a much more central kind of way of capturing our secular age than the new atheist version. Okay? And what's interesting about the sort of spiritual but not religious phenomenon is, in some ways, we might be to blame for it. Here's what I mean. I do think one of the things that the church needs to grapple with is our and I say this as a deeply reformed, card-carrying Protestant, that in some ways the Protestant Reformation unleashed a kind of Frankensteinish monster that outran us. And one of the things that happened was, and I'm not saying it was intended, I'm saying it was unintended. You know, in Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein creates the monster actually for a healing project. It's just that he can't control the monster once it's out of the box, right? One of the things that happens in Protestantism is, for all kinds of good reasons, we start gravitating to an expression of Christianity that is overwhelmingly sort of intellectual and heady and sort of talky. And in some ways, the faith almost gets sort of reduced to an intellectual system. And then you get what Taylor calls the excarnation of the faith. Right, we all know what incarnation is, which is the word becoming flesh and becoming embodied. He says in some ways what happened as an unintended outcome of the Reformation was an excarnation of the faith, where the gospel now just becomes distilled as this message apart from the embodied communities of practice that carry the gospel in powerful ways. I think that in some ways the spiritual but not religious phenomenon is its own rendition of that, because now it's just about having sort of inspirational ideas. I think the spiritual but religious, you know, the sort of eat, pray, love projects of the world are going to run their course and will show themselves to be fundamentally and ultimately unable to answer to the longings and struggles of being human. So my strategy is, look, just give them a long rope. Go ahead, try it. See how that works out for you. I don't mean that in an uncharitable way. I'm just like, I'm not going to argue you out of that. But what will happen is the paucity of that kind of spirituality, I think, is going to run its own course. And what's crucial is that the Church of Christ be waiting on the other side of that with a faith that is incarnate. People are not going to be looking for messages at that point. They are actually going to be the skylights are going to break open precisely when they are in spaces that feel strange and enchanted and charged and ancient. This is why, to me, the most robust postmodern witness we have is ancient Christian faith. And retrieving those resources. In other words, I'm almost a little bit grateful for this season in which people are trying these... It's not quite the right way to put it. All I say is this. While people are trying out all these other spiritual options, and that is part of a secular age, this is an opportunity for the church to get her house in order. And be robust communities of practice that are then willing and able and ready to receive people who are going to be looking for that and not just one more inspirational message. And I think that's the challenge. That's what the renewal of the church will look like going forward. And it also means that liturgy will be its own evangelism. Don't underestimate the way in which people might learn to belong before they believe. And I don't mean that in a trite sort of emergent church way. I mean that in... Is that... Can I say that? I don't know. I mean it in a deeply, deeply ancient intuition of the catechumenate. I think one of the best things that can happen is for church planning networks to recover the ancient catechumenate, which said, if the way that you are going to meet Jesus is by becoming enfolded into this community of practice, and you will do with us what we do, and you will get a feel for what faith looks like, that then will then bring you to the place of commitment. I don't know if that's controversial, but it's something we can talk about. All right, I'm going to stop there. Gosh, I'm sorry. Let's talk. Can we go to, like, we started a little late, I want to say, right? Let's you, Brian, you tell me when we're done. Questions? Yes, sir.
Commenting on the evangelism part.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. I do think there will be an ad hoc wisdom about when that's the move to make, right? And there's probably parallels in how we think about the formation of children in the faith, where this is, which has wisdom that's translatable. That doesn't mean treating new believers as children, but right, there's some sort of analogical wisdom about that. For some reason, I'm thinking about Kierkegaard, which I need to stop doing, because what Kierkegaard says is, look, even once you get all the sort of historical facts in place about what happens in Christ, you're still a long ways from actually getting the gospel, right? From believing the gospel. So there's probably I just think it so depends on the individual, right? If somebody comes, look, there will be people who come and their primary questions are intellectual. Then you absolutely should be answering those questions. But there's other people that you actually have to invite them into communities of practice so that they can even know how to articulate the questions that are rumbling around in their gut. They have the questions, in a sense, or they have, maybe question is already an intellectual way of putting it. They have the longing, and they don't even know what it's aimed at or what it's looking for. And I just think it's going to be fairly ad hoc wisdom about that. Does that seem fair? Yeah. Yes. Right. What do you think of this? So, ultimately, the big picture here is we need to have absorbed the biblical vision of what shalom looks like, right? So really, and I don't spend enough time talking about this in the book, but really I'm assuming, you know, what people like Nicholas Wolterstorff and others have articulated. Like, here's the vision of what God desires for the fullness of his creation. And now that becomes the index and criterion by which we measure what practices are sort of bent towards fostering that kind of life. Now, I think what's interesting is Augustine in the City of God gives us resources. This is volume 3 of my project, but it gives you resources for looking at those practices, not so much with a yardstick, but as with a protractor. And what you're trying to discern is some practices are more bent towards the kingdom than others, and it doesn't have to be an all or nothing analysis. So one of the things is you can actually come with a kind of common graced affirmation of some cultural practices that you can say, you know what, all things considered, that is a mode of life or work or whatever it might be that bears witness to something that God desires for his creation. So it doesn't have to be all negative and antithetical. So Augustine says, you know, when he looks around at the peace of Rome, the Pax Romana, the vaunted Pax Romana, and he sees all the sort of domination and violence, he says, the peace of Rome, give me a break, it's, compared to the shalom of God, the peace of Rome doesn't even deserve to be called peace. But then he hears the barbarian horde knocking at the gates, and he looks at the barbarian horde, and he's like, I'll take the peace of Rome. You know, it's kind of that relative, there's a sort of relative ad hoc analysis that goes on there, in which you can say, here are rhythms and practices that in some backhanded and yet still disordered way, nonetheless bear witness to something of what God wants from the world. That's where you can start from a cultural affirmation. Does that get at it? That's still pretty abstract, but...
Proximate.
It's proximate, yeah, it's totally, totally, that's right. Others, comments or criticisms, yeah.
So, in terms of filling this void, this trying to provide transcendence,
yeah,
like, purpose,
yeah. So, let's try this. Yeah, that's a great question. Part of this sort of paradigm is realizing that people are not primarily coming with intellectual questions. They are coming with sort of desires and longings that are looking to be fulfilled. And it's funny, you know, so let's talk about the Church of Apple for a second. You know, I'm sitting on the plane with my iPad, and I look, and the guy beside me has one of these Windows Surface computers, right? Now, never in a gazillion years am I going to buy a Windows product. But here's, the thing. It's a much better product. It does way better things. And yet what Steve Jobs has done, what you know, the sort of the R of Steve Jobs is he's totally suckered me into an aesthetic, a sort of vision, a way of life. Basically, Apple sold me a story that I want to be part of. And that's operative at a completely irrational level almost. And that's why in Desiring the Kingdom, I try to point out that in a way, marketing does a much better job of appreciating that we are desiring liturgical creatures than the church does. Because they're after our longings, and we're trying to convince people's intellects. And we will lose that battle almost every time. So, notice, none of that is anti-intellectual or anti-doctrinal. It's just situating it. And I think... yeah, I mean, I do think that, by the way, I don't think liturgy is some sort of silver bullet that solves it, because I do think it will be meaningful communities of practice throughout the week, right, that draw people in. I mean, one of the things that I think the sort of eat, pray, love spirituality, one of the reasons why I don't think it's sustainable is it is absolutely isolating and lonely and autonomous. You know, the autonomy that is woven into the vision of the good life in secular culture is exactly what most violates human nature, I would say. And so, right, it is very countercultural just to get people together and get them to submit to a community for the sake of others. That will be a powerful witness. It was part of the church's early witness, right? Look at these Christians, see how they love one another. That's what struck them.
Yeah,
great question. Others. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. I always feel really intimidated by this question because I just inhabit a different world, and so in some ways I feel like it's illegitimate for me to, part of me does not know the world that you're talking about. I just read about it in Christianity Today. Do you know what I mean? So, I'll just give one other report. I actually see a lot of people open and very hungry to retrieve this ancient wisdom. So part of it is just sort of where you're looking, right? I think one way that I do it is by trying to get people to recognize the formative and in many ways deformative power of cultural liturgies. So I actually come through a backdoor analysis. So instead of saying, here's why your churches should look Catholic. Anyway, you know, that's a small C if that freaks you out. Instead of starting there, what I actually do is I say, okay, let's look at our culture now and don't listen for message. I'm going to talk about this tonight a bit. Look at the cultural practices as liturgies and see how powerfully formative they are. And then ask, what are they making you love? And then I think one of the things that happens is once people wake up and see that those practices are loaded and taking us in a different direction, two things happen. They're like, whoa, we need countermeasures. You're not going to think your way out of that problem. Secondly, they will look at their so-called contextualized relevant liturgies and they'll be like, we just reproduce those in the church. That's what's going on, right? In the name of relevance and contextualization, what we did is we took a loaded cultural liturgy that's indexed to another version of the good life, and we thought we could sort of drop the gospel into it. But once you realize the formative power of the praxis itself, you realize you're just selling Jesus, right? So you have to, that's the kind of backdoor strategy, I think. But be encouraged. I actually, you know, I travel a lot around the country, and although I guess anybody who comes to hear me is probably already part of the choir in that respect. But I just do feel like there's a lot of energy among especially a younger generation who looked at the kind of 80s experiment, and they're like, what were they thinking? So I'm encouraged in that respect. Yeah, it's a crucial question. Others, thoughts, worries. Don't be shy. Yes. Why? Why do you say that? I want you to answer this question.
You're talking about evangelism and discipleship,
yeah,
and things that entail face-to-face conversation. You're talking about things that don't reproduce commercialism and selling something. You're talking about communities that practice rhythms together, so people that actually know each other.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's probably really creative ways to think about this. I do think so anybody who lauds the ancient also has to be a fan of cathedrals. And cathedrals were pretty big outfits, right? But interestingly, what happened is very, very few people thought of the cathedral as their sort of parish, right? In other words, your sort of centered Christian life would not very often be centered in the cathedral, even though you would all be sort of cycling into the cathedral. But there was something about the cultural witness and power that the cathedral had as an entity that also bore witness. So I could see that there are important opportunities for faithful presence for congregations that sort of marshal a lot of resources and therefore can be witnesses to their city in ways that the little... Because the one thing about just multiplying little congregations is there are sort of legitimate stewardship questions here, aren't there, about how dispersed our resources are for doing things like, for example, you think of other ways that will bear witness. I think the arts, for example, are a huge part of what faithful evangelism looks like in this kind of paradigm. Well, you need congregations that are big enough to be patrons of that kind of project. But then, obviously, the sort of rhythms of a Christian's life can't just be the big mass experience, it seems to me. And my hunch is there are congregations that are doing both of those things, right? Sort of pulling those things together. Very relevant question. Yeah, Brian.
This is a recovering fundamentalist question.
Yeah. Join the club. We're all... Totally. No. Except to say, yeah, no, I totally get it. And it's just the mess of discipleship, isn't it? Right? I mean, this is an ancient Christian problem, right? What did it look like to enfold people from their paganism into the body of Christ? And what's fascinating to me is, like, you read the letters of St. Augustine or the sermons of St. Augustine, and you see he's dealing with, like, really crazy stuff. So he has, I just read this great letter where he's writing to this really, I think it was Romanianus, who was kind of a patron of his and whose wife had died. And Romanianus wants him to sort of say a mass in her honor or something like that. And Augustine's like, hey, you know what? I'd be really happy to do that. How about before I do that, you stop going to prostitutes? Do you know what I mean? So there's this guy who wants to be like a patron of the church, and but thinks that that is not at all sort of inconsistent with this other way of life. And Augustine's like, hey, maybe, you know, we could think about... He's actually more forthright than that. It's so ad hoc. And I do think... The funny thing is, I spend a lot of time getting people to appreciate that there's more going on than thinking. I think that is also because I just assume that we're doing the thinking, and maybe that's the wrong assumption I should make. And it will be the case that really robust discipleship is going to get people in to see that there is a seamless web of what a gospel way of life looks like. And boy, we are not there. It's also why, to be perfectly honest, so many of our responses about gay marriage suck. Because we really don't have a whole cloth, seamless web picture of why people should be married, how they should be married, and things. So we kind of have created our own. We've created the buffet a little bit, I think. And I would love it. I do think that's where the intellectual energies of pastor theologians need to go, is in thinking through that dynamic. Absolutely. Yeah.
That would just speak to the objection that somebody would say, look at denominations
yeah.
that had yep. these practices.
Totally.
That got hollowed out of the gospel.
Totally. I'm calling it, so I'm working on volume 3 of the Cultural Liturgies Project, and I've taken to calling this the Godfather problem. Because do you remember that scene in The Godfather where it splices back and forth between Michael Corleone at the baptismal font? And bashing in a guy's head and not experiencing any tension between those two things. I don't know if this is, I don't want this to be a silver bullet either, but here's how I'm thinking about it. You tell me if this works. To me, the crucial difference between those two things is what I call, my friend John Whitley calls, liturgical catechesis. That is, I think in those traditions, which have had the liturgical heritage, which doesn't seem to have spawned Christians who then sort of embody that, is precisely because those traditions don't do a good job of helping people understand why we do what we do when we worship. And if you do that, then you're just going through, then it's just superstition, actually. And that's exactly what you see. It just becomes superstition. And so the difference is, for those of us who actually had, you know, kind of, what would you say, sort of head-centric discipleship, and then we come into those liturgical traditions, like, boom, this is like everything I've been looking for, but we're taking for granted this piece of it. The people who've been raised in those traditions and never got the... I'm calling it liturgical catechesis because it's specifically centered around helping people understand why they do what they do when they worship, when Christians worship, and then you enter the practices differently. I was in Phoenix, Arizona last weekend at Christ Church Anglican. And what was interesting is we did a sort of special Friday night service so that my talk about liturgy was embedded within a liturgical service. And you wouldn't want to do this every Sunday, but Chris Schutte, the rector there, what he did is at each moment, see, I think good liturgy is a chapter in a story, right? The whole thing is a story, and each move is a chapter. And at the beginning of each chapter, he would just say, now, here's why we do this, and here's why we do this, and this is what's going on when we do this. Now, you shouldn't do that all the time. But that is what discipleship would look like, and I think it would make a difference. On the other hand, I'm not an advocate of liturgical determinism. Right? I don't think there's magic here. I don't think, oh, if you just get all your liturgies right, boom, you spawn these cookie-cutter Christians. But it also turns out that our head-centric modes don't do that either. Right? So there's something else going on. Does that seem like a fair... Yeah. Okay, good. Yes, sir. Okay.
So I want to hear you talk about how wide the boundaries are when you talk about liturgy.
Gotcha.
Because doors of that cultural group did not receive everyone. And so when people who are outside that group came, they said to them, this is what Christianity looks like. But they were not imposing Christianity upon them. They were imposing their culture.
Yeah.
So how wide of a boundary is that?
Great question. Here's how I think about it. I do think that there is an ancient, small c Catholic heritage of liturgical wisdom that the body of Christ universal receives. I don't think that that fell from the sky. I think it bubbled up from the original source of all of this is Israel. Right? So it is partly a scandal of particularity that wisdom about formative practices grows out of Israel. And then the church inherits some of that. And now, in light of Christ, starts looking for what are the practices that by being led by the Spirit, we discern have this sort of formative power. I think there is a ton of room for innovation, reform, and improvisation within that. Let me try this. I do think it's very important that we not buy the story that our liturgical heritage is a European invention. It's not. It's way older than Europe, and it was in India before it was in Europe. Right? There's a liturgical heritage here that is. I just partly want to push back on the sense that this is so culturally conditioned. I do think it is culturally inherited, but I also think it has a transcultural power. So if I go see Christians in Indonesia today, if I go see Christians in South America today, if I go meet Christians in Russia today, if I go meet Christians in Africa today, they will all have been common inheritance. One of the first places where this heritage would have taken root is Ethiopia, right? So there is... Now, there are probably later, modern, totally just cultural layers that get added onto that, and then we confuse that as if that's gospel. And I think that's exactly what we need to push back on. But I do think that there is a kind of transcultural core that we can inherit and then still contextualize. I don't think it's either contextualization or liturgical inheritance. I think it's always inheritance in a context. Does that seem fair? It's messy. I just don't think... What would the alternative be? That we identify what? A sort of universal core or something like that? I guess that's kind of what I'm making a sense for, but it's historically inherited, if that sounds fair. And that to me is part of the scandal of particularity. Christ comes in the flesh in Israel, right? And then we are a people that sort of grows out of that. If that is ever used to exclude anyone, it is a complete misunderstanding of the inheritance. The interesting thing to me is, if I want to go to one of the most diverse congregations in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I live, I will actually go downtown to St. Andrew's Cathedral, where there will be Christians from all over the world that are worshiping in that context. So I think this is actually a crucial question that all of us need to be wrestling with. I feel like that answer isn't the answer that you wanted, though. We could talk about it. I would love to hear it. Come on. No. You can push back. Am I right, though? No. This is, I only come to things like this so I can learn. I have to learn, right? So tell me what's, seriously, I need to figure this stuff out. So what part of that is, where's the problem? I mean this honestly. I'll sit down. Oh, okay. No. But I honestly feel like there is a rich conversation to be had about this that I just don't want to miss out on.
Well, okay. That,
please.
I would contend that the gathering there is diverse, but there's lack of integration there, and many of them are there not because of a cultural identification, but they're assimilating. They're there in spite of their cultural absence. And it's because I believe that some of the liturgies, if you allow me this word, have been bastardized right? And then got contextualized to one setting.
Yeah.
And then we said, this is what Christianity is.
Yep.
So when we're trying to integrate churches, I'm talking to black pastors in my city, their immediate pushback is, if we do that, then our cultural norm, our liberties will be set aside for the sake of identifying with this new Christianity idea. But what they're really bringing us into is a European view of it.
Gotcha. Is there, would it make a difference if we could, I think I would actually want to accept that analysis for a lot of the sort of encrusted ways we've inherited it, and that what we think of as the liturgy is mostly a modern European version of it, and that we would actually be challenged and opened up if we went pre-Reformation. I know I'm not supposed to say that here. But so that I actually think that by going back further, we would actually find more resources for this. Just a kind of liturgical frame that actually has an incredible amount of room for expression, enculturation, articulation. So Catherine Pickstock at Cambridge says the historic liturgy was actually way more amenable to contextualization than the post-Trent, post-Reformation liturgies, which just said, no, this is the way you have to do it. So that if you go back to, I mean, think of Augustine, right? Augustine is part of a church in North Africa when he goes from congregation to congregation, on the one hand, there's a sort of, what could you say? There's a narrative plot that is common. But then the expressions of that will all be contextualized for the context that he's working in. I think that's what I'm talking about. Not necessarily this rock solid, ironclad package. Hey, we found this in Spain. You guys better sort of conform to this. I'm totally with you on that. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny, I don't know, we ended up talking about liturgy more than secularity. I want to be the last person who's confused with a traditionalist. I have zero interest in traditionalism at all. I'm interested in the logic that makes liturgy formative, and the only reason that works is because it enacts the gospel story, and we need wisdom about how to sort of embody that and contextualize that. Yeah. I'm sure that I've used my time and probably am eating up from... Who's in charge here? You in charge? Okay. Okay, great. Yeah, cool.
Discuss your understanding of the work of the Spirit within...
Yeah.
Based on your background, I'm kind of intrigued by your
totally.
Background and your understanding of... I think that when I think about Sunday, like, what are people's expectations when they come? And is it meeting with God? You
know, yes, I mean,
like,
right.
So the charismatics, they were there to meet with God.
Yes.
And sometimes they feel like liturgy or structure things get in the way.
Yep.
See, another people say we want to faithfully rehearse the gospel and be shaped by it. And so I see like this tension. I'm trying to embrace both of those. I say we want a present tense encounter with God and a long term shaping. But I'm curious to hear from you how you come to see those things.
So I totally want us to get over the false dichotomy.
Yes.
Right? And I think there are two ways to do that. One, obviously, liturgical traditions that fall into the trap of thinking this is about the liturgy rather than about God, right? So that's a huge problem. And for those traditions, what they need is precisely the gift of, I would honestly say, charismatic spirituality to open them up to remember the this, by the way, was the center of the Reformation's conviction about liturgical renewal. The primary actor in worship is God. So that's why you come to worship with the expectation that it's not just something expressive that we do, it is something that God is doing to us. Right? And that's why you want the form of worship to have a certain sort of gospeled shape to it. So you have to change people's expectations in that regard. When I talk to, I come out of Pentecostal and charismatic traditions, and still consider myself charismatic and reformed. When I talk to my sisters and brothers in the Pentecostal church, part of what I want to try to get them to appreciate is that the same spirit that is at work in the surprises and the miraculous is also the same spirit that makes the sun rise every single day. So there's just a different, we both need complementing pneumatologies. And in that sense, to realize that the Spirit is faithfully present to the practices. That's what sacraments are. Right? Sacraments are practices to which Jesus made a promise that the Spirit is at work in them. And they do work on you in ways that you don't sort of, are not spectacular, but are the long grind of sanctification. And so, and I think we can also have this to me, I kind of think heaven looks like a charismatic Anglican church. Okay? Don't tell my boss that. But what I mean is, I think you can have liturgical guardrails that also carve out space for waiting for the Spirit to act in ways that are unexpected. So you can have, and you need it. You need liturgies of expecting the unexpected. And to me, that's not at all mutually exclusive to inheriting the accrued wisdom of the Spirit in the liturgical heritage. It's just that most people don't know how to do both of those things. So it's interesting. I'm a member of the Christian Reformed Church, and our denomination is officially non-cessationist. That is, we believe that all the spiritual gifts remain operative. It's just that when we try to act like we do, it is ugly. It's like, please don't. I'll go to a retreat or something, but just don't. Bunch of white Dutch people who usually sit on their hands. It's like, oh, no, please stop. So there's that to me is, and my sense is that actually it's congregations outside of our denominational streams that tend to put these two things together, because you have a freedom that some other heritage, you know, you come with a lot of baggage in whatever stream. Does that help? Yeah, great. Great, thank you.